Okay, so this was H.R. 4437 proposed to construct a 700-mile immigration barrier along the U.S.-Mexican border to criminalize illegal presence. So I believe actually being in the U.S. without papers would have been a felony under 4437, and also aid to undocumented immigrants. So remember Mahoney in Los Angeles said, okay, if you pass this, I will instruct all of my priests and nuns to violate it, and they will violate it as an act of conscience. And so there was a lot of people in the immigrant rights community were very alarmed at this sort of aid to undocumented immigrants provision. It passed on December 16, 2005, by margin of 239 yes to 182 no, Sensenbrenner bill. But the bill as a whole then failed in the Senate. I mean, obviously, the 700-mile immigration barrier worked its way out of the larger bill and then eventually was passed. But I don't believe it was funded. And as far as I know, we don't have it in place on the southern border currently. Okay, so because of the relative importance of H.R. 4437, and also because it was relatively tough, it was sort of an enforcement-only approach to immigration policy. For public opinion scholars, this was a golden opportunity to see exactly who votes for anti-immigration legislation. With, even IRCA, it was hard to say. I mean, if you were a House member in 1986, and you voted yes on IRCA, does that mean that you were pro-immigration or you were anti-immigration? Sometimes it's not clear, because there were elements of IRCA that were pro-immigration and others that were more restrictionist. And so it was hard to say sometimes. But with H.R. 4437, there really wasn't anything that was pro-immigration that was sort of good for the immigrant community in that bill. And so it's a way to sort of see, in sort of the starkest terms in legislation, who votes yes. Okay, if you look at Table 2 now in the handout, this summarizes the results of the analysis. So the first column is just sort of a district traits model where I listed different types of traits of the congressional district. That representative's district, and I pulled it out of the congressional bunch of congressional quarterly documents, some stuff online and Lexis and so on. So if you look at this model, the first column's regression suggests that representing district that was in the South or the West, so the South is basically the old Confederacy, the West is almost all the countries that border, well, all of the states that border the Pacific Ocean, plus one or two farther in. I think like I coded Arizona's West as well. Or if you were from a heavily blue-collar area. So if many of your, or if a disproportionate number of your constituents were blue-collar, working class, then you were more likely to vote yes on H.R. 4437. So this is a district traits model. On the other hand, if you represented a district that was disproportionately Asian, I mean, this is intuitive, Latino, obviously, but actually not particularly intuitive, African-American, you were more likely to oppose the measure, so to vote no. So there seems to be a sort of combination of material and non-material causes at the elite level for 4437. The second column is a full model where I included not only the district level traits, but also more of the member traits. So here again, I pulled stuff, basically biographies of the different representatives, out of Lexis and out of some of the congressional almanacs. Here, if you look at a House members, being a first-term House member, or a Republican made one more likely to vote yes. I think the Republican is fairly obvious. First-term House member, the argument here is that if you're not quite in, you just got elected, then you're concerned, obviously, about getting reelected the second time. And even though House members have a very high rate of being returned to office if they choose to stand for reelection, nonetheless, one could make the argument that they're a little more concerned about public opinion in their district, and so they're more interested in voting yes on 4437 to show that, yes, they were being tough on immigration, especially on illegal immigration. Interestingly enough, however, the ethnicity of the representative, him or herself, did not matter. And again, that seems fairly counterintuitive. Okay, so what are the political implications of these results? One, being a Latino member of the House had no statistically significant effect on whether that representative voted yes on H.R. 4437. Now, this is multivariately, obviously. I'm sure at a bivariate level there would have been an effect. So at least on immigration issues, perhaps a non-Latino House member would do just as good a job as Latino member representing the will of Latino constituents, which, you know, that seems, that's not necessarily obvious. The second unexpected result was that the most influential determinant of the H.R. 4437 vote was the proportion of African Americans in the congressional district. And again, African Americans, why not Latinos, or why not Asians, but instead African Americans? So despite allegations that African Americans are afraid of losing jobs to Latinos, these data, at least at the elite level, suggest that African Americans, at least elite African Americans or their constituents, are influencing the elites to make common cause with another disadvantaged racial minority, immigrants from Latin America. Pro-immigration activists and politicians could therefore maximize their chances of success by making more efforts to form pan-ethnic or sort of cross-racial political coalitions. The third political implication, I think, is that electorally, the anti-H.R. 4437 effect of representing a congressional district with lots of Latinos suggests that the long-term prospects for these sort of very harsh enforcement-only bills may not be particularly good. You know, we haven't been scapegoating Irish immigrants lately. You know, the German Catholics of the 1800s that people were very upset about because they drank beer and they even gave beer to their little kids. You know, you don't hear much about them in the news much. And so I think, you know, in the long run, when most districts have a significant voting population that is Latino or sympathetic with Latinos, then, you know, in the long run, you're not going, it's going to be very difficult. It'll be electorally problematic for representatives to vote for these anti-immigrant measures. So instead of thinking only about how to please white Anglo or, you know, Anglo constituents who oppose immigration, so think about Sensenbrenner. You know, Sensenbrenner's district, I think, is 95% Anglo. He doesn't have to worry about anything, you know, in the suburbs of Milwaukee. But if you're obviously anywhere in California, pretty much anywhere in the West Coast, and increasingly, you know, places like Northern Virginia, you know, I grew up in Northern Virginia, Prince William County, and there's a huge immigrant population there. Immigration is a huge issue now, not just from Latin America, but also from the Middle East. And in the, you know, in 10 years or so, it's not at all clear which way an immigration, you know, the immigration vote will, how the immigration vote will influence the people in that particular district. It may well be that the electoral prospects for the representative from that district will be on the side of pro-immigration rather than anti-immigration legislation. Even if you have more Latino electorates in a particular district, it doesn't necessarily mean that the anti-immigration politicians are going to be voted out. You know, think about Bob Dornan. Remember Bob Dornan? He, you know, eminently quotable, very colorful character. Pro-immigration, he was not. And so, you know, eventually he was voted out with great fanfare, and he was replaced by a Latina, Lourdes Sanchez. And so, you know, in the long run, it's not just that you're going to have the Bob Dornans voted out, but also more politically conservative incumbents who keep their seats in ethnically mixed districts will sort of moderate, will be influenced to moderate their stances on electorally critical issues as immigration. So it's possible that, I mean, given his personality, maybe not, but conceivably, you could have had, say, a Republican in Bob Dornan's district who, you know, got religion and said, okay, I repent of having, you know, bashed all of the Latinos in my district, and, you know, instead I'm going to, you know, do things that are more reasonable, that are more moderate on immigration. It's possible that someone like that could have stayed in office. So then briefly, and again fairly superficially, I'd like to just sort of conclude by listing the probable winners and the probable losers in the current status quo immigration regime. The winners, I think, obviously the employers of immigrants, whether the immigrants are documented or undocumented. If you look at undocumented immigration, it's obviously much more profitable for an employer running, say, a sweatshop in El Monte to hire someone, work someone for half the minimum wage under, you know, non-OSHA conditions, and not have to worry about the worker asking for higher wages, for maybe unionizing effectively, for complaining about working conditions. Or, you know, think about in the Central Valley, places like Oxnard, there's some growers that even arrange to have their immigrant workers deported just before the last payday of the harvest season. This is from a former student who grew up in Oxnard, and, you know, you'd have these growers who would knowingly hire hundreds of undocumented workers to pick the crops in Oxnard during the summer, the harvest season, and then just as the harvest was ending and the pay was due to the workers, you know, the day before, they would call up the growers would call up the INS and say, you know, we have a real illegal alien problem here in Oxnard, and you have got to get them out of our fields. It's a terrible problem, and they would be gone the next day. And obviously, it was a great boon to the grower, because this particular grower didn't have to pay those salaries, the wages to the workers. So employers and immigrants in general, I think, are making out. The immigrant smugglers are obviously making out. They're charging much more now than they were, say, in the early 1990s. Or remember the chart that Roger showed, looking at the price of a coyote. I take my immigration, my urban class, down to Mexico every semester on field trips. And I remember in the mid-90s, we were down right at the Border State Park. And there's sort of tube that goes between one side of Border State Park and the Tijuana side. And on one side of the tube, there were about five migrants just sort of waiting to cross. On the other side, this was sort of the migrator. So we were going out with the Border Patrol at night, and they were just sort of talking. And so we were asking the questions, you know, like, how much do they charge to cross? And one of the migrants at the other end of the tube claimed that he could get a coyote for as little as $100, which seems even then quite low. And my guess is the success rate of that particular coyote was not particularly good. That was a kind of Walmart-type smuggler. But nonetheless, clearly there's been an increase in the smuggling fees since the mid-1990s. So, you know, now you're hearing just sort of on the street prices, you know, in thousands, low thousands of dollars or even higher, depending on where you're coming from. And obviously this is Latin America. If you're coming from, say, Fujian province, then I've heard estimates of like 60,000. So you mortgage your house in Fujian, your family's house, and you come with maybe only half of it, and then you work basically as a slave in, say, Chinatown, in a Chinatown factory in New York City to work it off. And if you don't work it off, then very bad things happen to you. This is just sort of Latin American. So smugglers have been making out pretty well, I think. They've also been increasing their profits by double dipping. So not only are they smuggling people, they're also smuggling drugs. And they found that they can, there are certain advantages to smuggling people and drugs at the same time. So you can take almost a retail amount of drugs, give it to a particular migrant crossing, you know, in a plastic bag, and say, okay, go over and give this to X on the other side. And the actual coyote doesn't have anything on his or her person. And so if he or she is caught by the Border Patrol, it's not a problem. There's no evidence. It's just the migrant's problem. But that, the smugglers get money in the end for smuggling the people and also for smuggling the drugs. The third group that's been doing fairly well, I think, are immigration enforcement personnel. Both Clinton and Bush have been pumping all kinds of money, millions of dollars, into immigration enforcement. And many of the Border Patrol agents are, you know, sort of ex-military or ex-police. And so it's a kind of welfare program for law enforcement personnel. And I think even under an Obama, I can see immigration enforcement staff increasing. It's hard for me to imagine immigration enforcement, you know, ICE's budget going down under any politically imaginable future scenario. Another group that's been winning, arguably, in a relative sense, are probably most, at least undocumented immigrants. So again, as Roger showed earlier, you are economically better off in the United States, even undocumented, than you are in El Salvador, you know, in the countryside, or, you know, think about Guatemala in the countryside, or sort of a rural migrant into the cities in like Guatemala City. Even if you did have a job in your home country, you're almost certainly making much more money in the U.S. Than you are, you know, in, say, Latin America. I remember right after the peso devaluation in the 1990s with Mexico, you had Mexican medical doctors coming to Alaska to work in the canneries without papers, because they could make significantly more money canning fish in Alaska than they could practicing medicine in Mexico. Or you'd have middle class, actually fairly affluent families in Mexico come to the U.S., like the Central Valley, and do migrant farm work for a season to earn enough money to sort of go back and then support an even more affluent life in Mexico. Finally, I think the typical native-born consumer is getting a fairly good deal out of our current migration policy. So a consumer gets inexpensive goods and services. If the native-born were to, you know, the only ones available to, say, pick crops in the Central Valley, then strawberries would either be much more expensive than they are now, or the whole industry would move somewhere else, you know, maybe farther south into Mexico or, say, Chile. Okay, who loses? Finally, I think migrants who have to cross the border without papers obviously are losing, and many of them are paying with their lives. At this point, thousands are paying with their lives since Operation Gatekeeper in 1994. I do a lot of work. I have a lot of friends in the Central American community here in Los Angeles. One of them is from Guatemala, born and raised in Guatemala City, works as a pastor in the valley. Entered the U.S. for the second time without papers in 1981. In 1981, he simply had to walk across the border. It was pretty much a simple operation, and then he was in. And even though he was undocumented for about 5 years until he was legalized in 86 under IRCA, life was relatively tolerable. So, you know, it was a relatively short period, and things were not as bad for undocumented immigrants as they are today. Especially since 1994, however, it's become increasingly onerous to cross the border from the U.S. into Mexico. People have been living in fear of deportation now for 20 years or even more. There are even cases, I take my class down to Casa del Migrante, which is it's run by the Scalabrini Fathers. It's a kind of, it was originally an Italian order that just concentrated on immigrant rights. In Tijuana, it's Colonia Postal. And when we were down there, there was a guy who had been deported, and he had been, I think, living in New York City for like 30 years or something. And he simply hadn't, you know, he would have been eligible to have gotten papers under IRCA, but he didn't for some reason. Or you have people who, you know, they're just stopped at a stoplight sign in Lancaster, they're working in construction in Lancaster, and they're, they don't have driver's license because they can't get one under, you know, the current administration in California, and then they're deported. So, you know, what are they going to do? Things like that were a little less common in 1981 when he came. Many migrants now are dying in the desert of dehydration. There's an Ellingwood book that is really outstanding on just sort of the physical danger to migrants crossing. You know, talks about, he goes down to El Centro in the morgues and looks at, you know, they try to identify bodies that are washed up in the canal down around El Centro. Or people die in the mountains of cold in the winter. The Casa de Migrante in Tijuana, if you go to the south side of the Tijuana Wall, right across from the Tijuana International Airport, they have one cross. The Casa de Migrante is a form of protest. It's put up one cross for every migrant that they know has died trying to cross since 1994. And it's a very impressive sight. It goes basically as far as I can see. If you start at the end at the airport and you look out towards, say, towards Tecate, you sort of, you can't see the end of them. And then, you know, with the numbers of, a number of them, you know, it's just a cross. The person died at a certain point, a date. Others have actual names. They were able to identify the bodies. When I visited Casa de Migrante last year, I believe the number was over 4,000 people that have been killed trying to cross. And I think, you know, some of you are probably more familiar with the literature on immigrant deaths at the border than I am. There was an IMR piece that came out a couple years ago that was quite good on it. Another possible loser are, at least in the short run, local governments. In the short run, if you only look at the first generation, some economic studies find that local governments spend more money on services for immigrants than the immigrants pay in taxes. This is, you know, economics of immigration literature is extremely contentious. People yell at each other at conferences. It really depends on what assumptions, you know, what is your accounting method? What do you put in? And I think, unfortunately, ideology has a lot to do with the eventual empirical results. But nonetheless, it's quite possible that local governments in the short run are paying a disproportionate amount of, say, taxes, tax money going, putting them into social services for immigrants. Over the entire lifespan of the first generation immigrant, however, And certainly over the lifespan of his or her children and grandchildren, even the local governments, I would argue, would be able to recoup their expenses and the even greater tax payments that they receive, sort of over one or two generations. It's also possible that native-born working class people are losing out somewhat. So the literature on immigration economics is, again, very contentious and sort of up in the air. But some studies find a slight wage depression effect on native-born workers who compete with working-class immigrants for the same jobs. And this assumes, of course, that there's not a dual labor market. And I think often there is a dual labor market where native-born working-class workers simply will not apply for a particular job, under any conceivable wage rate or any conceivable improvement in working conditions. And so you don't really have migrants and native-born working-class people applying or really competing for the same job. But I think economically it would follow logically that if employers are more likely to hire immigrant workers at lower wages, even below the minimum wage or under less favorable working conditions, then conceivably you would have at least some wage depression effect on the native worker. Finally, in an absolute sense, I think most undocumented immigrants are losing out. So if they had papers, they would be able to unionize more easily, arguably more effectively, earn higher wages, work under safer conditions, not have to worry when they get up in the morning, go to work, whether they will be still in the United States to come home and see their families in the evening. So, okay.
Thank you very much.
About two talks and then have to leave, it looks like. So we actually have a kind of reduced number here. I think we can be a lot more informal. Usually we try to discourage much back and forth and discipline our presenters to wait for a while. But why don't we just play it by ear and see how things go. Maybe we'll get a couple questions from the floor to begin before we ask Joel and Rogers to respond. Let's see. Who would like to begin?
I think Roger alluded to this in the beginning of his talk, but I would like to hear both of your ideas about what might be done, not on the domestic front, but on the international front, to encourage people to be able to stay in their home countries. So, for example, when you brought up the case of the El Salvadorian family, if had the U.S. not supported the military in the civil war there, there might not have been such a big push for them to be driven from El Salvador. And I'd also, I don't have the precise figures, but if there's a lot of evidence that there's particular domestic economic policies, say, in Mexico or in Central America, that also created great income disparities and drove people off the land and therefore having to migrate north. So I just want to get maybe some more of the domestic push from the home countries rather than just the pull factor from the U.S.
Okay. Yes, go ahead.
Both speakers focus on public attitudes and determinants of public attitudes to immigration. And I guess Professor Feltzer at the end mentioned the contentious nature of the discussion of whether immigration was actually or where it was a burden or a benefit to the society. But I'd like to hear a little more about that. Is that unknowable? Or, I mean, we have great statistics, on different cuts of the population, but can't we know something about whether immigration is a net burden or is it a benefit to the society? Are the attitudes well-founded in some cases? I'd like to hear what both of you
say. I guess I'll call myself. I'll ask two questions. What do you think it is that determines this political salience, has determined the political salience of the issue? Because obviously there's been, in my untutored, from my untutored opinion, it seems as if, or it, I should say, it just seems as if there are periods in which it's a very, it's been very intense, which is recently, in particular, quite intense. And you go back into, there's a period in the 90s, it was very big. And I mean, one issue, one thing, of course, is whether there's legislation that's being proposed. But there, I guess there's a question behind that. When does that happen? And, you know, so, anyway, that's the question. First, what are the factors, or what historically has made this issue a salient one or a not salient one in politics, such that, you know, really matters what they think, what they, how they, what position they hold for how the outcome is going to be. They have to take an opinion. Second question, from the standpoint of unions, one could sort of see abstractly why unions might oppose, you know, more immigrants. The obvious issue of job competition. Of course, it's much, as you've explained, it's infinitely more complicated than that. But the way the issue seems to be playing out in this country at this point, the huge question appears to be how to treat the 12 million immigrants who are already here. If I'm not misunderstanding. In which case, it's hard to see why unions would not be entirely favorable, because the condition, they're going to face competition in the labor market from people who are without papers, meaning, you know, who are really disadvantageous, and who, of course, they can't unionize, who are much more difficult to unionize. So, what am I missing? I mean, why aren't the unions, by and large, pro-immigration, given that the issue is constituted this way at this point in time? So we've had four questions. Maybe we can go back and go the opposite direction. Maybe
sure,
start with Joel and then to Roger.
Okay. Let's see. I'll ask. With your last question, I mean, I think your argument.
I mean, of course, it's all the good.
Right. I think your description of the reasons why unions currently should think about being on the side of, say, undocumented immigrants or supporting a more liberal immigration policy explains why, you know, since, in the last 10 years or so, at least, they've been relatively interested now. They've been much more on sort of the pro-immigrationist side, politically, part of the coalition. But I think historically, the people who have had power in unions, in the most powerful unions in the United States, so not, say, the IWW, but you know, AFL-CIO type
unions,
have tended to be you know, working class Anglos, and you know, we're in the 1800s, working class Anglos or working class sort of the more established ethnic groups, and so there's this sort of issue basically of race historically in a lot of unions, that it's, you know, they're not following Marx's dictum that all of the workers of the world unite. It's, you know, it's the same thing in France, that it's basically workers of a particular nationality, a particular ethnic group are united against, unfortunately, another group. Or you think about the Chinese Exclusion Act and the politics of that in California. It was led by an Irish immigrant, Kearney, and he had this sort of basically a union going against the Chinese who were here. And they didn't really see them as fully human. They didn't see them as the kind of creatures that could be unionized, really, or that would ever be in their union. I mean, there are examples of unions that have been relatively pan-ethnic, especially, say, in Hawaii. Eventually, the workers in Hawaii on the plantations realized that it was in their interest to unionize not just all the Filipinos and all the Koreans, but all together, so a truly working-class union. And that was much more effective. But I think there's a huge racial problem historically in unions and their attitudes towards towards immigrants. Let's see.
So you would say even countering their apparent economic interest here.
Right.
You can see why people wouldn't want immigrants to come in. I mean, all else equal, it seems, well, they can take my job. But if they're here ready.
I mean, you know, look at historically, look at the Chinese Exclusion Act, you know, or why were the Chinese miners driven out of the gold fields, you know, in the 1850s and 1860s and 1870s?
and the miners from Argentina and the miners from Australia were not. You know, they were white, so that was basically the argument.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Then the question about what political salience. Well, I think historically people tend to get more concerned about immigration when the economy goes poorly, so in a condition of a recession. You know, again, historically, in the U.S., when we've had a significant recession and we've had, you know, measurable immigration, then you've had anti-immigrant movements. I mean, during the Great Depression, we didn't have a huge anti-immigration movement because we didn't have, we basically had negative immigration at certain points.
Yeah, but there was massive deportation of Mexicans.
Right, there were, right. I mean, that would be the example where you had basically open borders with Mexicans. You know, we went into the barrios of Detroit and deported even native-born Latinos, Mexican-Americans. And, you know, in the late 1800s when you had recessions, that was also the time when you had lots of anti-immigration movements. I think politically you tend to get it often when the political elites decide that it's in their advantage to scapegoat certain ethnic groups. And so, you know, I mean, with the Chinese, why did they target the Chinese? Well, I mean, Chinese were not legally even allowed to testify against whites in the courts. And so they simply were not an electoral force that had to be taken into consideration, and you know there were relatively few of them as well, and so it made electoral sense to scapegoat, say, okay, if you elect me, I will take care of these nasty people, the Chinese, and then you know, all of your troubles. I mean, sort of classic demagoguery, scapegoat politics, historically. So I think when the economy.
What's going on today?
I think that would be certainly part of the story. I think Tom's question about, there's also the economic effects. I guess the situation is, I'm not really an economist, and the particular models that they use, they're not necessarily always the same types of models that I use. It is knowable, and you know, there's a large literature on it. I mean, you might look at Borges at Harvard in the Public Policy School, and there's Barry Chiswick, I think, at Illinois, Chicago. Those are sort of some of the two of the major ones, and they tend to have polar opposite views. But it's a question of how do you sort of cut it. I mean, like Borges in some of his models says, okay, immigrants are not paying their keep because they're not paying enough to support the military effort. Or, you know, there are military expenses that are incurred, but immigrants are not paying for them. And, you know, it's just a question of what you count and what is your perspective. I mean, like with local governments and the use of services, do you take just undocumented immigrants from the last 2 years, or you assume that they're going to be naturalized, or they're going to be legalized down there, or they're going to have families here, and those families are going to continue paying taxes? I don't know. It just strikes me as highly ideological. That you know, people want to come up with a particular side or a particular empirical economic result, and so they cook the data as necessary to get there. There's a guy at Rice that who methodologically is just, I mean, it's just ridiculous. But it's patent that the guy is just sort of coming up with his empirical work based on his empirical findings based on his politics. You know, and I think it's probably true based on, you know, both the left and the right, but. In that field in particular, it seems to be highly ideological. So yes, I mean, there are real studies and real economic models, but and overall, economists tend to be very positive overall about immigration, the economics of immigration, even of illegal immigration. So there was a study, I think, by Simon, Julian Simon, in like the late 80s, early 90s, current and former presidents of the American Economic Association, the Economist Association, and I think people on the Council of Economic Advisors, sort of the very top economists in the U.S., and the vast majority of them were very positive about immigration as a whole, and half of them were positive about the economic effects overall of undocumented immigration. Now, that's very different from what a common sort of person on the street thinks. So the economists tend to be very positive overall, much more positive about economics, the economics of immigration, than the public in general. I mean, I personally think that immigration overall doesn't have a huge impact one way or the other on the economy. not, I mean, not huge compared to, you know, globalization and other forces.
So, there is no.
There is no. I don't think there is.
There's no clear.
I don't think there's any clear, hugely positive or hugely negative effect.
Self-interest.
Right. I mean, there are certain groups that do better or do worse, but overall, I think, I would say overall, there's either, you know, basically no effect or it's slightly positive, overall. Yeah. I mean, there's a book by, I mean, my favorite book probably in the subject is, I think it's called The Economic Consequences of Immigration by Julian Simon. He's unfortunately passed on, you know, that sort of summarizes the literature up to the point at which it was published. You know, Borges has other books, but they're much more critical, and it's more sort of his work as opposed to literature review. Let's see, then about Latin America. I mean, I think certainly, you know, if we don't, like with the Salvadorans, if we hadn't been training at the School of the Americas, you know, death squads, the ones that gave us El Mozote and, you know, the massacre of El Mozote, if we, you know, didn't give them arms and advisors and things like that, if we didn't go around saying Guatemala and or Chile and, you know, send the CIA down to overthrow democratically elected, relatively progressive governments, then we would have many fewer massacres and much less of a refugee flow into the U.S. You know, so certainly if we had much more sort of EU-style economic development of Latin America, we would have much less immigration in the long run into the U.S. Now, I mean, whether that's good or bad sort of depends on who you ask and what your perspective is. But, you know, the EU, basically, when it accepts a member, it says, okay, you're going to be a member, but they don't just sort of leave them there. They say, okay, well, our development money is going to target Romania, or it's going to target Poland, or whatever country that has just come in. And that tends, in the long run, to decrease economic inequality in that particular country, and then overall in the EU. So it's a much more sort of egalitarian approach than, let's say, NAFTA. NAFTA really doesn't have that level of economic aid. So I think in the long run, certainly if people who are happy, who have jobs, who have decent lives in general, don't have to flee for their lives. And so if we didn't cause things to be very unpleasant for many individuals, they wouldn't come here. I think with the Mexican case, another sort of footnote is that demographically, I've seen studies on the demographics of Mexico, and some of the studies have been arguing that they've sort of gone over the demographic acceleration point, so the growth rate is actually declining, and so in a generation or so we might have relatively few Mexicans coming to the U.S. It would be more farther south where the economy is not doing as well and where the growth rate is much higher, and also that's another reason why you have immigration, because you have relatively high population growth. I mean, I think like Guatemala has a population growth rate of around 5% per annum, which is quite high, and that's geometric progression. And so, it doesn't take long to get a very large population, especially in a rural area where the number of jobs is relatively fixed. If we increased education in those areas, that would tend to reduce the fertility rate and also increase job skills for people. Yeah.
Roger.
Okay, so maybe I'll start where Joel just left off. I mean, I think the issue of the relationship between migration and development is of tremendous policy interest today, largely because the view, I mean, I think for two reasons. One, the view and or the hope that if one could somehow do something about development, one could reduce the rate of migration. The other, I think, reason for the interest is that it may be that, or it's clear that the migrants are more or less spontaneously are doing things that have very significant impacts on the countries from which they come. Most importantly, they're sending remittances. The problem, I think, in thinking that development might, the problem with, I think, all of these hopes, which you find in the World Bank, the International Law Organization, there is the IOM, International Organization for Migration, the Inter-American Development Bank, the problem, and the comparable agencies among the European countries, the problem is that actually development fosters migration. So migration is costly, and so as a society develops, it generates resources that allow people to move. So In a way, if the kind of advanced societies wanted to do something for development, they should focus on Africa. But that would not do much to reduce migration from the Caribbean or from Guatemala or from Mexico. Okay, so question. Then there was a question of the net impact of economic impact of migration. So the National Academy of Science organized a large-scale study to assess the impact of migration in the United States, and there's a report called The New Americans that was published in 1997, available online. So I'm just going to summarize the one paragraph.
National
Academy of Science. The report is called The New Americans. Overall, in the massive and complex U.S. economy, immigration is unlikely to have a very large effect on relative earnings or on gross domestic product per capita. Among the legions of factors that affect the economy, many are far more critical than immigration, including savings and investment and the human capital of U.S. workers. So I think that's the consensus. So that really what and the reason it's consensus because there are both costs and benefits, and the real issue is that kind of distributional one. Who is it that benefits? Who is it? That's the question of the posed by the topic of today's workshop. But the net is somewhere close to zero. And so
is that assuming the same rates and levels? That study.
Well,
because you said immigration restriction is relatively effective in the way the law.
But
the law
it would works. Yes. I mean, of course, as with everything, there's a lot of contention about this. But I think the general assumption is that if there were unrestricted immigration would be good for the world, bad for the developed societies. I mean, bad in the sense that would be then living standards for the people in the developed societies would significantly diminish. So not everyone agrees, but I think the consensus and it's entirely consistent with what Joel just told us about the views of mainstream economists. I mean, how can they not think this way? So.
The New Americans said that this is overall the world.
This is a study of the impact of immigration on the U.S.
Okay.
So the argument is kind of just straight line projection. Difficult to imagine a significant thing given the size of the economy and given all of the other things that are affecting. But which is not to say that particular groups won't experience. There'll be distributional effects among different groups of Americans, but overall, the effect is fairly close to zero, which suggests that the reaction is driven by the types of cultural factors that Joel was describing. So then Bob's two questions. So I think that, to try to understand the political salience of migration, I think one has to kind of link the kind of sociology of migration to the politics, and I think the salient development in the sociology of migration of the past 10 to 15 years has to do both with the greater stability of, in particular, the kind of Mexican, most Central American migration, but then the dispersion of the immigrant population throughout the United States. So when IRCA was enacted in 1986, immigration was a localized, regionalized phenomenon. Small number of states with large immigrant populations, New York, New Jersey, Illinois, Florida, California. And even within those states, a small number of metropolitan areas with very large immigrant populations. Well, what has happened in the really part combination of IRCA, which allowed the former undocumented immigrants to go where they please, right? One no longer had to kind of being, and especially in the kind of low, the environment that Joel described of the 1980s, in which a place like Los Angeles, one was relatively, there was kind of supportive infrastructure for undocumented immigrants, relatively protected. So undocumented immigrants stayed in the places where there was very high densities of migration. Well, legalization then allowed the former undocumented to go wherever they wanted. And then the kind of heating up of the U.S. economy in the 1990s led to a greater dispersion of the undocumented population. So now wherever you go, there are significant immigrant concentrations. And a good measure of this is actually the the number of Mexican consulates in the United States. And I think that there are now 49, and it will be 51. And I think the new ones are, that are going to be opened are in Alaska and Hawaii. So, I mean, and indeed, I think you go to virtually any state in the United States and you see a significant Mexican population. So it's, I think the nationalization of immigration, shift from a kind of regional to a national phenomenon, it's something that, that has had a very great impact. So again, I mean, and then I think there is the issue related to the you know, the spillover effects of the intensified border control. I think in, you know, a state like Arizona, that part of what is driving the local politics of this is the spillover effects related to trying to tighten that border. Now then the issue of the unions and legalization. I mean, I think that if you look overall at the policies or the American unions, they're pro-immigrant. I mean, in fact, they've been pro-immigrant for at least 20 years, pro-immigrant in the sense of being in favor of legalization and taking a very proactive, energetic stance towards the organizing of immigrants. And I think that's true for the AFL-CIO, Change to Win, it's true for the construction unions as well. The issue for, I think, organized labor is, you know, the kind of, the, is comprehensive immigration reform. Are they, I mean, the AFL-CIO simply could not get, whether rightly or wrongly, it's not clear, it could not get itself to pay the price involved in a new guest worker program. Right? They were for legalization, but they were unwilling to go along with a very significant expansion of the guest worker program, whereas Change to Win, most of it was willing to go along with them. Now, whether that's left or right, I don't know. But I mean, I think that's the. But I think that's the issue that certainly they felt, you know, in the summer of 2007. And again, depending on how this thing plays out, whether or not there will be an effort to kind of reform the whole, the you know, try to reform the system overall, or whether to attack it more piecemeal. So I think if the issue is let's legalize the 12 million. Then I think there's no difference within the labor movement. But if the issue is then legalized, and then it's a much more complicated question.
The temporary.
Well, that's
the,
right. So
the,
is
the
it
new Bracero program?
Well, okay. So and then should, I mean, the other, okay. So one is the new Bracero program, but the other is then reallocating categories within, among the legal immigrants. So should, I mean, clearly the right wing or the business wing of the immigrationist coalition is in favor of reducing family. I mean, again, you know, it's driven by the entire direction of the policy is driven by the overall resistance to opening the doors, right? So that the fundamental objectives is have a doorman, make sure that you're selected, keep the door relatively closed, much more closed than it would be if people were allowed to migrate freely. And have someone that was actively culling the migrants you want. Well, so business wants to have fewer family members and wants to have more occupationally oriented migrants. Well, the labor movement sees that again as another source of, or at least some segments see it as another source of competition.
Okay. Yes.
Just going off the economic argument we have. You know, most of the mainstream economists, even Borges, who throws in all these, you know, other variables, you know, can only find one group being harmed, which is high school dropouts. And that's only like slightly 1 or 2%, which is very minimal.
2%,
but overall, there is a...
It's 2% of the labor force. It's a very small group.
2%, of the high school dropouts in America. They're the only group that is maybe directly affected by throwing all these things. You can look at some of the studies done by David Carr.
You mean literally dropouts, so they don't
high school dropouts.
School.
That's
right.
The only level they're competing.
It's very small.
Yeah, and as far as going labor, you know, we've seen this shift to organized labor going to organizing undocumented, at going even into organizing day laborers who are the most marginalized of. So, I mean, that's a direct sign that the AFL-CIO, you know, who has a history of not being so supportive of immigrants, is now really embracing. You know, unionization for sort of the reasons that Professor Brenner has pointed out. You know, it's only sort of logical to unionize this force. But one of the main sticklers remains the guest worker program, which would, you know, really try to institutionalize, you know, reinstitutionalize, like the Bracero program, which was, you know, goes against every norm of having a, you know, decent living, a decent life. So my question is, how in the foreseeable future, even with the more progressive, say, I mean, if you want to call, you know, Obama a progressive candidate, can we, if we stick to these neoliberal economic reforms, can there be sort of this almost humane, you know, using the rhetoric of John McCain, can this, there be this humane immigration reform happening? As long as we stick to sort of, I see these things as sort of in contradiction. These
which things?
These neoliberal economic policies, you know, these, and going along with foreign interventionism and sort of developing a humane model of immigration reform.
Okay. Yeah, Brian?
An anecdote first. You see me, I'm stereotypical Anglo-Saxon Gentile. My father was a Bracero. He was born in Pennsylvania. And from 1943 until 1945, he worked on a railroad. And they imported 50 Mexican laborers at a time for a track working camp in the New York Central Railway, rebuilt their whole track during the war with Mexican labor. They had 6-week contracts that alternated. You could come for 6 weeks, you had to be out of the country for six, and then back again. And some of those guys during that time came every other 6 weeks for the working time. The other thing I wanted to ask you about was the Colorado farmers complained that the state instituted a draconian immigration policy just at the time of the harvest. And they had an awful lot of trouble, and they complained about it loudly. We heard it in the press here. They said they weren't going to put a crop in next year unless something was done about this, because they couldn't guarantee that they would have labor to take in the crop. So any commentary you want to make on that?
Brian, would you?
Yeah.
Further? Yeah, Maria?
I was just wondering, based on this notion of the best and the brightest, why isn't it that the DREAM Act, why has that not passed? Why has that been so unsuccessful?
Okay, 3 questions. Maybe Roger?
Well, I mean, the, you know, the search, the DREAM Act doesn't do anything for Microsoft, right? I mean, I think you know, the DREAM Act has a significant appeal, and you would think that it would have, that its appeal would be more potent than it has turned out to be. But I think the DREAM Act appeals to the kind of left component of the immigration coalition, not to the right. The DREAM Act would provide a route. So, I mean, this is one of the issues in the kind of, you know, immigration reform. One of the issues in the immigration, so in reform kind of community is, should one kind of go down the route of comprehensive immigration reform, or would it be better to try to do it piecemeal? Right? So one small piece of overall immigration reform would be to target the undocumented children and young adults, particularly those who have lived all or most of their lives in the United States and who are currently enrolled in higher education, want to go into higher education, or would be willing to go into the military. So the idea of the DREAM Act would be to legalize that component of the population. Now, I should say that there is, you know, there's this article, I think, either today or yesterday in the New York Times about the, you know, large number of immigrants who are in the military and the difficulty that they're having in naturalization. There's a lot of interest in military circles in, I mean, they're like Microsoft. This is a good way to get more soldiers at a time when, you know, the military is not terribly attractive. But I think the fundamental appeal of the DREAM Act is essentially a human rights appeal. It's not a kind of a market or self-interest appeal. It's been blocked in Congress. And it's a relatively small component of the population. The costs are relatively low, but I think the symbolic value is such that it's nowhere.
That article in the New York Times was about dead soldiers who had gone in
assuming
that they would get citizenship. And now
but anyone who has served in a legal residence of served in the army or should be on a accelerated track to citizenship.
But their families are having
a lot of
trouble.
That's right.
These dead soldiers.
That's right.
I think with the DREAM Act, I mean, the politics of it are not obvious. I mean, if you're Sensen Brenner and you're looking at a 95%, Anglo constituency in the suburbs of Milwaukee, the DREAM Act is not going to get you reelected. It's seen as a vote loser at the election for most representatives, I think.
There are other questions if you guys...
Well, the issue, I think that, agriculture, I want to respond to the question about the Colorado. I mean, I think that from the standpoint of farmers, nationwide, there are never enough workers, right? I mean, you can't have a large enough labor supply, by definition. And so any tightening, and Joel was describing, the new Bush policy of trying to show, well, we can, if you're not going to pass comprehensive immigration reform, well, then we're going to tighten up enforcement. This may indeed be having some effect. So I think it's certainly possible that there may be shortages of field workers. But on the other hand, those shortages have to be evaluated in the context in which there have been incredible surpluses. I think that one would have a very different type of agriculture today had the supply of workers not expanded in the way it had.
Yeah, I think a lot of, not just in Colorado, but especially in the Central Valley in California, a lot of growers are complaining about. There was also the effort, the Bush administration about a year ago, I believe, tried to get all employers to verify that all of their employees were documented, and they were going to run it through the Social Security computers and see what came up. And then in theory, if their names didn't come up as being here legally, then they would be given like 90 days to clear it up or to be fired, basically, or else employers would be sanctioned. It turns out, I guess, the Social Security system has like a false positive rate of about 11%. And so it went into the courts, and people like it's a coalition of, I think, the ACLU and some business interests said, you can't do this, you're going to shut us down. And some of the growers then were saying, yes, I mean, last time we couldn't get enough workers because you were enforcing the immigration laws too strictly, and the crops just rotted in the fields. And in the early 90s, there were arguments like this coming out of the Central Valley as well. I think Philip Martin at UC Davis does a lot of work on that issue.
Gary.
Yeah, I have a question about the political salience of immigration at the national level, as an issue at national level. And it runs along these lines, that in Europe, where immigration has been often a much hotter national political topic than in the United States, which started earlier, it's nevertheless quite difficult to identify cases where immigration was actually really politically decisive as an issue at national level,
meaning
in determining elections, for example. I can think of one example in England in 1974. It's true that the Labour Party probably was elected because Enoch Powell, a kind of racist on a racist platform, defected from the Conservative Party. There's one case there, but generally speaking, what you see in Europe is that immigration becomes a hot issue, but it isn't actually very salient in national political terms because all parties, left and right, converge quickly on more or less restrictionist policies. That seems to be the general thing, so it doesn't become a very divisive issue. Now, in the States, it seems from what the two of you have been saying, that the situation is a bit different, that here you have this more unusual a splitting effect, that the right and left are kind of almost equally split on the issue, so that normal political divisions don't really operate. And so my question really is, how far is it the case that in the United States, it's a very visible issue, increasingly so, but it's actually one that's in a curious way self-canceling, because there isn't, as it were, a very strong ideologically motivated coalition on either side of the debate, because it's so mixed.
I just want to add a tendon to Perry's question. Do you think that in 2008, it doesn't look like he can, because he's historically associated with a different position, but it would be good for the Republicans to make this issue salient. It would be a plus or minus.
Well, I think,
and you can say whichever. What would they do? I mean,
I don't know. I think the argument that it should necessarily be more salient. I mean, like if you look at the 2008 election, before this was the Republican campaign consultants before 2006, the 2006 legislative election, were saying this is what they were banking on, and even like my parents' district in Northern Virginia, they were sending out, the Republicans were sending out all of these, illegal alien flyers, and, we're going to be awash in illegal aliens if you vote for the Democrats, and so on and so forth. And the Virginians, for the first time in certain districts, voted for the Democrats. So it didn't seem to work as planned, at least in a lot of districts. And so I would argue that at least in 2008, it might not necessarily be rational. I think with Europe versus the U.S., one issue that makes the immigration debate in Europe currently so hot is because in Europe, especially post 9/11, in Europe and Western Europe, the typical immigrant, at least in the public imagination, is Muslim. Now, if we had predominantly, Iranian, what would be a better example? Saudi, predominantly Saudi immigration to the U.S., I think the political dynamics would be significantly different, and the debate might be even hotter. It might
would
be just
be a
as
debate?
Vicious.
I guess Paris would there be a debate?
Well, maybe there wouldn't be a debate. I mean, both sides would be viciously
anti-immigrant.
I think, in Europe, you're much more likely, the electoral rules are slightly different, and so, it's more likely to be a parliamentary system with a true multi-party system. And so, you can get a National Front, you can get a Progress Party in the Scandinavian countries, you can get, Republican or German People's Party, whereas it's much harder in a winner-take-all system like the U.S. I think there are some examples where maybe in Europe immigration might have arguably played a role in the ultimate outcome. So I'm thinking about, I think it was the 2002 French presidential election where the socialists lost to Le Pen. In the first round,
right.
I think arguably, depending on how you work your hypotheses, your scenario, alternative scenarios, that might have played a role in Chirac's winning, or it might have played some role. Some of the German elections at the local level arguably have been influenced by the immigration debate, which, whether you had an anti-immigrant party go in or not. In Britain, the argument was a little bit earlier, so you have like the Rivers of Blood speech and things like that. And many of those, sort of like what the Germans did in 93, the English did earlier, like in the early 1970s. They basically adopted a slightly more moderate form of the extreme anti-immigrant party. And then people said, well, why should we vote for the really hardcore anti-immigrant people when, our friends Thatcher or whoever have, they've adopted very similar policies, or the SPD in Germany, they basically adopted a lot of the sort of anti-asylum rhetoric of some of the reps.
The Netherlands.
Well, again, in Netherlands, Netherlands is a fascinating case. I'm not as familiar with the electoral coalitions in the Netherlands, although you have the Pim Fortuyn. That arguably had a role, at least when he was alive. And there again, Islam, that the Muslims are Muslim, or that the immigrants are Muslim, plays a huge role. When was it? Van Gogh, I think, was murdered. Or the Ali, I forget her name. There's a. She's at American Enterprise Institute, for a while. That plays a role, at least at the local level. Or the Burqa debate in the Netherlands. Also, an interesting footnote with the Netherlands. I think under the current Dutch immigration regulations, if you apply for naturalization, or if you apply
to emigrate into the Netherlands, you're shown this video which is, includes, I think, like a topless woman and a gay kiss. And this is a way to sort of show, you know, we're proud. And, you know, if you're from Saudi Arabia, you know, you better be able to deal with this. We are Dutch. And you know, there are some slight nuances in cultural difference between the Saudis and the Dutch.
Well, okay. I mean, I think, you know, the salience issue, I think in general, immigration is of lower salience. I mean, I think that the kind of baseline view, certainly the American public is, you know, say both of us have indicated, baseline view is that immigration should be controlled and further restricted. But relative to the other issues about which the public is concerned, immigration is of lesser importance. But I think there's the kind of latent animosity towards immigration is something that political entrepreneurs can and do activate. So I think that's certainly what we saw here in California in the mid-1990s, and I think in large measure that's what we're seeing elsewhere in the United States. Of course, the potential to activate it, as I tried to argue, is affected by the fact that immigration is a reality with which a growing proportion of the American population comes into contact. Now, I mean, I think that, you know, how one assesses the degree of contention among American political elites and political leaders ought to be evaluated relative to the things about which they're in agreement. So I think, you know, one of the things that Joel emphasized is the, you know, growing harshness of the environment for undocumented immigrants. So the increasingly stringent efforts to control, to deter illegal immigration movement across the border, the much greater difficulty that undocumented immigrants will have in finding jobs and securing benefits, all of those things are going to continue. That is, there's nobody, I think, on left or right, who's saying, let's tear down the wall. The whole, you know, comprehensive immigration reform is predicated on employer sanction. So I think that there is a significant degree of consensus, certainly among, I think, the political elite, that reflecting in part responding to public views, that the environment ought to be tightened up for unauthorized migrants. The division is, well, what should one do about the unauthorized migrants who are here? And of course, how should one alter the allocation categories of illegal immigrants on the lines? Again, I mean, I think that the higher level, you know, if you compare the United States and France has been very, I mean, the whole controversy in France is not driven by growing immigration. In fact, you know, relative to where it was over the 20 years ago, France has a lower proportion of the population that's foreign-born. It's really an issue driven by questions having to do with second-generation integration and the kind of reaction. I mean, the kind of, you know, the French reaction to the unhappiness of the equally French second-generation North Africans. So that's a very and you know, again, the French are also looking for a way to try to find, encourage the migration of the best and brightest, but I think that is more significantly circumscribed there by the, you know, by a public view that is, you know, culturally much more hostile to immigration.
Okay, I mean, we're approaching 5 o'clock. I think everybody's had a chance to contribute, and a fantastic afternoon for us. I want to thank both of you guys. Your talks fit together beautifully, and the questions, you know, were beautifully answered. So we really want to thank you.